Welcome to the RAND CRE Show. Commercial real estate with no stone left unturned.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the RAND CRE Show. I'm your host, Mike Taravella, and I have a recurring guest slash new co-host for this week, Adam Labar. How are you doing today, Adam?
What is going on, Mike? Thank you very much for the offer to co-host.
Yeah, thank you so much for being on. And I'm super excited for our guest today, Sergio Altomare of Hearthfire Holdings. They have about $35 million, maybe even more in a couple months. We'll do a follow-up episode just recapping everything, primarily focusing on self-storage, but also taking advantage of opportunistic trends in real estate. So welcome to the show, Sergio. How's it going?
Awesome. Appreciate having me, guys. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, so I think given your bio, you worked for had a little bit different trend into real estate, working for the Fed. How did that kind of transpire, working from one and evolving into the other and going full time into real estate?
Yeah, so it is certainly an interesting path, and I won't take all of the credit for being my the direction being all on me. I was fortunate enough to meet and now marry my wife Corinne, who at one point in my career kind of set the stage for the transition. I did work for the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia and Richmond for a combined 22 years, all in IT. In those years, I did everything IT related, both locally in Philadelphia and nationally for our national IT group. Worked on a lot of different projects. My passion was always technology. Worked from being a file clerk to eventually an executive. Along the way, 2012 is when I met my now wife, Corinne. She started working for the Fed as a kind of a side hustle relative to her her day job, which was music and opera. And that literally wasn't paying the bills. So she got a different day job and transitioned into IT project management for the Fed. Her family had been investing in real estate their entire adult life, introduced us to buying multifamily properties, income properties. That was our way of preserving, building, growing wealth, and as well as cash flow. That turned into a syndication business after a few years of having access to more properties than we had capital to deploy. Being a bookworm and research junkie, kind of took that as a really good opportunity to create a business. I didn't realize I was doing that at that time, but did that over the, you know, we started syndicating 2014, 2016. We grew our property management division, as well as our syndication business, to where it was just a matter of how do we transition from the day job. 2016, the wife quit. 2017, I quit. And the rest, as they say, is history.
So I think when it comes to scaling, I think a lot of people think of the investing arm of things and not necessarily the property management. What made you go into scaling that property management? Is it just the wanting to be vertically integrated, or is it a different factor that you had in mind?
So we started investing in small multifamily. My background being IT and technology, I was well aware that there would, for anything that we do system process wise, there's always a component that can be done more efficiently using the right technology. So for me, it was natural to want to look at, okay, what is the best software platform to manage our small portfolio? And I was always a firm believer just in a discipline of being a technologist of, you know, developing a system process, get it nailed down, and then try to automate the heck out of it. So having the system, having the platform in place, and I always built everything we did to scale. So we started with just our small multifamily properties. Corinne's parents were in the process of selling some properties out in California, buying some properties local to us, knowing that we now have the ability to manage. So we started building the inventory and the portfolio over time that way. And it just naturally became an extension of what we did. And we decided to keep that business. Now I probably spend maybe 5 to 7 hours a week in that business. We still maintain, we have about 150 units under management. And it kind of does dovetail a little bit and kind of feeds our syndication side, because as an individual investor, you may want to buy a single family home, a multifamily property, and that immediately exposes you to some of our syndication deals. And now we're advocates of diversifying even within real estate. And so from there, we've brought quite a number of individual investors to our syndication deals. So we find a really nice synergy there.
Yeah, I think it's super important. I think a couple of things to hit on were, I love systems. I'm not as IT, but I think in the Excel world, I think Adam can contest and say.
Oh, very much so, yeah.
I've automated as best I can in Excel, but definitely envy your background in IT. But I think it's as you built to scale. I think a lot of investors, when they're first starting off, is looking at it as a cost. But I think you have the perfect mindset of investment of what does this look like 3, 5, 10 years down the line. And because you think like that, it allows you to open up opportunities on the management side, which also create different avenues. Like you said, that single family isn't a burden when you already have 100 plus units in the area, and allows you to continue to scale up while it's incremental costs in the long run. So I think that was a key part in your story that really resonated. And just like the property management, creating synergies as well, right? Of having the investment flow and the process. And you must have been doing something right if the family's pulling out of California to invest locally to where you guys are.
Well, and a lot of it comes down to, like, I always have this mentality. If you're going to do something that's going to take, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 minutes, and you know it's very likely that you're going to need to do that same thing again. So it makes sense to templatize it, right? Create it. I don't care if it's an email, right? If you send the same emails, copy and paste, right? Copy and paste. Well, everything that we do from, you know, leasing, listings, responding to tenant inquiries, from the get-go, everything was designed to be repeatable. And I think where a lot of people make the mistake is they think that, oh, I will come back and create, I need to get this done right now. I'll come back and create a system. I'll come back and make it repeatable. And when you operate that way, you're always going to be, you know, behind the gun, if you will. So doing it up front, it may take you 45 minutes to do this 10-minute task, but then from there on, it may take you 5 seconds.
And when you're setting stuff up like that too, when you create those templates and you're creating those things, you provide a lot of value. What I like to tell people all the time is, you know, I like to invest in multifamily where there's a value add in either form or function. And by templatizing, you're setting up all of those functions to go so smoothly. You're actually increasing the value of your properties just by implementing something like that, which obviously your investors have to enjoy. So that IT background obviously has helped you out in pushing that forward. So,
well, and the IT stuff really comes into play really even a lot more in self-storage, right? So the properties that we target, I mean, they're value add, just like any other, most other asset class that syndicators get into. But what the business plans look like, in many cases, are really implementing two parts, is customer facing interfaces, websites, and, you know, the ability to reserve and rent online. And then on the back end, being able to automate all of the workflow. So our first self-storage facility that we bought in 2019, it was an owner-operator family business since like the mid-80s, and it was all paper-based. And so when I looked at it, I said, this is not a per se real estate play. For me, it was a technology play, right?
A software update.
Yeah, I mean, and that was pretty much, we didn't have to go renovating kitchens and baths, right? I mean, I implemented some tools and technology and, you know, just make it self-service, and, you know, it's humming along now. So I look at it, it's kind of like in my wheelhouse now. I mean, self-storage is just awesome for that.
How did you build the bridge from property managing multifamily to then self-storage?
It's not the part that's different with self-storage is that self-storage is far more of a business than it is real estate. Yes, the storage facility is on real estate land and whatever, but all of it, a lot of it comes down to two things. One is the general operations process from a day to day, week to week, month to month. And there's plenty of resources to learn that. But then it's also where you get the generate the most equity and value in self-storage is on revenue management, right? So similar to the hotel industry, you have to manage your pricing dynamically. And there's tools and systems to do that. But that is really where the rubber meets the road in one storage facility from the next, right? If you ever go to a self-storage facility's website and they have static prices on their website, meaning that they don't change their prices, but every couple of years, these are the properties that we're like, we licked at our chops on, right? Because we basically implement our revenue management plan. And so the pricing that you see on the front end is dynamic. If you go on a website on Monday, you're going to get a different price than you're going to get on Thursday. And we use technology and algorithms, just like the hotel industry, to really drive that. So that was really, it was really sexy from that standpoint. A lot of folks getting into self-storage, if you get, they get into it thinking that it's, it is a straight real estate play. That's where they kind of get a little, out of tune and out of touch with it. So I think feel like we have a pretty good advantage there. But the same disciplines that you have in multifamily can translate into self-storage. The underwriting is a bit different. How you look at a, you know, you got to look at a supply demand analysis. You got to look at, you know, rent per square foot, per capita. There's a lot of the numbers that you look at are going to be a little different. But once you're exposed to it, and that's really not that big a deal. And there's, you know, I got a library of books. So I'm always of the opinion that I'll dive in deep, learn as much as possible, and then try to piggyback and take advantage of the many people in the industry that just are open to teaching.
A lot more looks at self-storage. So what are you looking at? So obviously you've looked at multifamily before, more of an opportunistic type ventures that all kind of correlate. So what are you seeing now? There's more and more people going into self-storage. Do you see it continuing on the trend that it's on, or do you think you're going to have to pivot again, or what are your thoughts on that?
So we think that there's, and we have a pretty good team that really we keep a strong pulse on the industry. We know a lot of people in the industry. You always look at what the major players are doing because they spend a lot of money on watching the market. When self-storage, and I don't know the exact time, but as of say like 10, 15 years ago, it was close to about 80% of facilities where single operators that had maybe one, maybe two facilities, right? That number is now 72% are still owner operated, smaller ownership. Maybe they own one or two properties. So there's a lot of pressure. So we operate in secondary, tertiary markets. We don't play in the primary markets, as I'm sure you're not buying multifamily properties in New York City because there's no returns there, right? So when we look at the markets that we're in, there's still plenty of inventory that's mom and pop owned. There is more pressure from other syndicators, sponsored private equity groups that have pivoted into self-storage. It is a shiny object. In some markets, we're seeing some, you know, overpaying, but we're still buying in the six and a half cap rate. And our model is to build a portfolio of properties where on the back end, we have a really good exit with a portfolio sale. So depending on who you ask, even on my team, there's either a 5 to 10 year window that we see that it's really going to be a continued hot market. I look at it in shorter timeframes. It might be 2 years where we need to start thinking, what do we do in the 2 years following? So I think there's a lot of, There's still plenty of leg room. There's a long enough runway in the industry. There is a lot of consolidation. We're seeing REITs. We're seeing big private equity firms target the same markets that we are. That's good and bad. It's good because it's showing that when we have our exit, that they're going to be buyers. it's challenging because in some cases we got to be aware of them being able to them overpaying because they're not trying to generate the returns that we are. And in all cases, we're still a lot more bullish in self-storage than we would be in any other asset class. Industrial stuff, last mile storage is but we're targeting 5 years from there. You know, we'll pivot. I don't really care what the asset class. We love real estate. We love what we're doing. I think we can learn to underwrite just about anything, and we'll go where the trends are going. I mean, that's pretty much, we pivoted from multifamily to self-storage, whether it's industrial cold storage, maybe it's a renaissance of office space. I don't care. It doesn't matter.
Given, I mean, I think you hit a point of like the consolidation trend and all, I mean, it's happening in single family, happening in multifamily. With your investing thesis, do you, when you have scale in a market, are you kind of at a point that you're willing to probably overpay just because the investing thesis is the next 5 to 10 years, cap rates will go down, and the fact that we're having an institutional buyer? I think a lot of people don't understand that trend, but at the same time, I think it's important. Like once you have scale in a market, what's that volume that you feel kind of comfortable, I don't want to say overpaying, but yeah, continuing to build foundation in that portfolio because your thesis is to exit to a portfolio.
Yeah. So, you know, the notion of overpaying really does come down to what that long-term strategy is, right? So when we go into a market, I don't want to take down one property. I want to take down two properties. If I can take down a controlling interest in a property, right? Well, now I am the competition, right? So if you look at a map, and right now we're under agreement to buy 5 properties in Indiana, right? And if you were to look at it on a map, they're strategic, right? And it's essentially two owner groups that we're buying from, but it just makes logical sense. Now, we wouldn't, the idea of overpaying, I mean, there's always going to be that, yeah, we can't cross this number. But if it came down to, you know, taking that market and taking the controlling interest, and it fits our profile, where if I take this property and snap it into the grand scheme of things, I'm not overpaying. Right? Going into a market, that's where we'll look at it a little bit more. But in many cases, like with our Lancaster portfolio, we went above asking, but that's because we were already in the market and we knew that we were able to even go even more aggressive in rates than would have been forecasted because we're already in the market. So our strategy is always going to be, we don't want to be one and done. We want to have as much as we can as a controlling interest in a market, providing it makes sense.
Yeah. Have your investor return profiles changed because of that? Because I think like with investors, like even Adam and I underwriting deals before, and we were talking about it a little bit. It's just like that return metric, like prices have gone up, investor returns or like the expectations have stayed the same, but something's got to give. So have your investors like come, I'm sure self-storage, like it's different, but have you seen kind of that change in investor expectations?
Yes and no. I mean, we're big advocates for having a solid investment strategy and conveying that to our investors, right? When we made the pivot from multifamily to self-storage, a big part of that message was, we don't believe we can generate these same returns. And so rather than us adjust expectations down, we're seeing another asset class that we can generate the same returns. Now, we are mindful that it's not always going to be, you know, 17, 20% IRR. So, but we try to be proactive about it. I'm not going to pitch an investor saying, hey, we're doing, you know, these deals are, we're underwriting about a 19% IRR. And oh, by the way, here's one at 12, right? And what changed overnight? So I think that they have an expectation that they're trusting us to know a market, to know an industry, to do all that. And really it's just an education thing. So I feel like we've retained from our multifamily to self-storage 90% of our investors, but it was, and I'd have to ask them, I feel like that's the message that they got was that we didn't say, we didn't wake up one morning and say, hey, we're going to invest in self-storage. We it was methodical. We went out and we said, where the market is frothy in multifamily, we're considering selling. And we obviously didn't have to ask for permission. However, we made it a point to say, this is our game plan. You know, we want to get your feedback. And they're like, yeah, I'm in. And so we set the stage. This is our goal. It's going to sell these properties, recapitalize all you guys as investors, and then move to self-storage. And so we did that. We set it in motion. So there was a process, and it, you know, it helps us to make sure that we're sticking to a coherent message and strategy. And then telling them what we're going to do it, and then make that pivot and transition. And just like we've done that as of 2 weeks ago, we've moved outside of the Pennsylvania and our immediate market. I mean, we pivoted to essentially up and down the East Coast, not as far northeast. But in doing that, we had to present this thesis. And basically it is that we find that our model of adding value in the properties that we're identifying can work in other markets. And we know that they're not going to be, you know, an hour and a half ride away, but we're planning for that, whether it's looking at third-party management, whether it's looking at how do we augment our management system. You know, we basically set the stage for it. They're on board. If it's a coherent message and strategy, then they're usually on board.
So I think that sounds twofold then from what I'm hearing, right? So one, as with anything, deal with investors or anybody, is communication, 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 right? So over communicating to let them know what the plan is, and then also knowing who your investor is and knowing who your investor isn't, right? So you knew who your investor was, kind of what they were looking for. So if you know you have an investor that's looking for a short-term flip that wants, you know, to return his money in 6 months, then you're obviously not going to pitch a long-term buy and hold stuff to him. So knowing your investors, saying, all right, these guys are looking for this percent of cash on cash, this type of IRR, and pitching the right deals to them and helping them understand what it is, and just not worrying about the other investors who may want something else. Like that's quite all right.
And it helps when you pay them.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. So, you know, apparently you did that because you kept 90% of them. So kept them coming. So
no, and that was it, right? I mean, when we made that pivot, a big part of having the credibility to make the pivot is to have a track record of going full circle with an investment, right? I mean, if we didn't have any track record of any successful exits, it's going to be like, all right, well, number one, it'd be more difficult because we'd have to go back to the well and find new investors. But it made it that much easier to return $1 million in returns. And those investors are going to just be like, yeah, I'm in, you know, you
want to go in. What else am I going to do with all this money?
Yeah. So that made it far easier. You know, there's a lot of sponsors out there that have done a lot of buying, not a lot of selling, you know, so you have to have the track record.
Yeah. Yeah, we're generally buy and hold investors just because we internally, like you have like the internal property management team, but generally trying to refi and roll. So then we're returning capital because you can sit on a property for 10 years, but if you're not paying investors, right, row.
Yeah, exactly. It's dead money.
Awesome. We want to, as we kind of transition toward the end, we ask all of our guests our investor pro tip. I think I have an idea what your pro tip may be, but we'll cue it up for you first.
So I'll probably throw a little monkey wrench in. You're probably thinking it's going to be systems and processes, right? So I'm thinking more. So what I've actually found over the last few years, I shouldn't say last few years, the last year or so, maybe year and a half, is two things that have really propelled my business and me personally. Number one is being plugged in with the right people. That fine gentleman up there on my top left, Adam.
I know if you want, I can just leave the podcast real quick.
Joining GoBundance and being surrounded by guys that are just kicking ass in so many different areas really exposed me to a group of individuals that will not only support you, but elevate your game. That has been instrumental, as well as recognizing that in order for me to grow, my company to grow, I need higher level resources to partner with. And we've done it a little unconventional because I don't have a boatload of money to pay a bunch of $100,000 employees. So we partnered with the right like-minded people that want to grow something big. And it's not easy because not everybody's getting a paycheck, but we are, you know, equity partners in our deals. So I think that for me, had I done that and found at least that one partner years ago, we would have probably gotten, you know, bigger faster and been able to, and I don't mean just getting bigger and faster for the sake of it, but more to have some real strong growth. I mean, there's probably a bunch of opportunities we missed in 2013 to 15, just because we didn't have the resources, bandwidth, expertise. But now we are moving at an insane pace. You know, over the next couple of months, we will have acquired probably over 10 properties in six, eight months. And at the pace that we were at years ago was about one or two properties per year. So my pro tip is really twofold. One is plug yourself into powerful networks. There's plenty of them out there, not guru, where they charge a boatload of money and do whatever. And then the other piece of it is not be afraid to bring in some partners to help you scale.
Yeah, I'm actually part of the Ascend group, which is the lower tier GoBundance. And I second that aspect because
that's awesome.
It's helped not only just like the clarity and the other aspects of life too, because it's that not only like-minded in business, but like the well-rounded piece. Because I think in entrepreneurship, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, you're like, if I'm not working, I'm going to die. And you're like, no, there's other aspects of life. So like my 2020 was like head down, underwrite, not like, and that was like a really rough year because we weren't doing deals because this stuff didn't pencil out or we lost. So I would promote just getting in that like-minded group as well. And I honestly thought you were just going to say checklist everything in your life and systematize it. So I'm glad I was wrong because it was a really, really strong answer. Adam, anything to add on that piece since you're part of GoBundance and have been part of different groups?
Yeah. So, I mean, I spent 4 years before I got into real estate doing nothing but education by myself, because as far as I knew, I was the only person that wanted to invest in real estate. And then I finally got into like Jackie Gino's group. And within 6 months, I was closing a deal. I was a passive on another and I was working on others. Just getting yourself around like-minded folks, getting into GoBundance has been, you know, mind-changing for me. Like just the shift, the way I have to look at things. Like every time I get into a different group of people and I'll always be the dumbest, always be the poorest person in the room. Like that's always my goal. So, I cannot emphasize enough what Sergio said is get around like-minded people. You are the five people you hang around with most. So make it count.
Absolutely.
So Sergio, if anyone wanted to get a hold of you, self-storage, GoBundance referrals, how can the listeners reach out to you?
Directly at Sergio@hfireholdings.com. That's H-F-I-R-E holdings.com. Connect with me on LinkedIn. We have social media posts, social media accounts. I don't know what they are.
But you can find him.
Yeah, that's who, not how, right there.
That's exactly it.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, we have a team that handles that now. I personally am not a big fan of social media, but I understand LinkedIn is probably your best bet. Or just shoot me an email. I love connecting with people. That's pretty much it.
Awesome. Well, Sergio, appreciate it so much just on the on all the different aspects from self-storage, the being the dynamic flexibility to move, and also the importance of network and especially like groups like Abundance and whatnot. So thank you so much for being on and providing a ton of value. And if anyone has any questions for me, you can reach out to me at mikeT@randcre.com. And until then, we will see you next week.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Sergio.